once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the, or second hour, of the Person All Wealth Coach, as performed by ChatGPT. No, not really. We just talk that clumsily sometimes.
Yeah, I do anyway.
I do. I'm fully admitting. We are here to talk some more about the economy and about some personal stuff too, personal finance stuff. Right before the end of last hour, I said we were going to talk a little bit more about why we had the fall in productivity followed by the sharp rise in productivity, and that we predicted it. So going into the pandemic, we saw mass layoffs. We saw a lot of huge amount of unemployment insurance was offered, huge amounts of stimulus, direct stimulus to the economy, direct as paychecks to people to keep them from stopping their successful business because of an outside factor that had nothing to do with the day-to-day operation of the business. So those of you that have listened to us for very long know that we think those stimuli that we gave to the economy during that time period were effective in keeping us out of a depression, keeping the whole world out of a depression. We had a very, very short recession and no reason to come out of that recession except for the stimulus, because people didn't get hired back quickly enough for us to have a one-month recession. There's just no way. So come forward, that stimulus money is part of what's pushing us forward. With that massive layoff, we saw a jump in productivity because those that stayed working were essential and were generally the best at their job. Not always. Sometimes there's those unfairnesses that happen, but generally across the board aggregate, we have better, the most productive people are the only people working. So it looks like per human hour, we're producing more. Good. Then the economy starts booming. We're coming back to work. We're going back out to eat. We're doing things that we've got this pent-up demand to do. Manufacturing has to figure out how to change things. We've got all these new people coming back into the workforce. And they're not, in essence, they're not all going back to the jobs that they left before the pandemic. A lot of them have now changed completely. People that were waiters or waitresses, our delivery drivers, and the number of changes that took place in the service industry, in the hospitality industry, and in manufacturing, it was just phenomenal. We had a massive shift of who's working where. And that comes with a massive drop in productivity. You bring somebody in who's used to waiting tables and you tell them they are now operating the canning machine. Well, somebody has to train them. And the person that's usually selected to do the training are the most productive people. That causes productivity to go down. Productivity is measured by how many people are working, how many hours are they working, and how much stuff are they making in those hours. Well, we've taken our most productive people off the line to show the absolute least productive people how to do stuff. That is a loss in productivity in any way you measure it. It's just harder to produce more stuff when your best people aren't producing stuff and your new hires aren't producing stuff either. We said that was going to happen and it did. Well, why did we say? So how did we, what was it about our crystal ball? It wasn't a crystal ball. This is just what happens when you hire new people. You can't find the perfect person for the job almost ever. This is in a very rare situation where you put out an advertisement and you say, I want to hire these specific skills, and that person shows up. That, if you've ever been in a business, you know that's not how it works. If it does happen that way one time, you talk about it the rest of your career. So you got to train these people. That means productivity drops, and your trainers are also losing productivity because they have to deal with the newbie. Well, eventually, the newbie's not a newbie anymore, and that's where we are. When we see a 4% increase in labor productivity in manufacturing, it's because people are understanding what they're doing now. We're seeing hours worked down by 2%, and yet the real output is up by 2%. So you're working less and making more. That's awesome. And overall, our productivity is higher than it was pre-pandemic. We're getting better at it. And some of that is automation. We're beginning to see the automotive boom that has been invested so much in over the last several years to add to our productivity. It's happening. So all of this stuff is coming together, and all of that stuff is fantastic news when it comes to inflation. It's fantastic news. I mean, we're just saying this. Productivity's up 3.7%. Inflation's up 3%, and hourly compensation's up 5.5%. That extra productivity above inflation is getting paid for. People are getting paid more money because they're producing more things. That's anti-inflation. When you have too few things and you have too much money, you get inflation. So you have more things being produced for less money. That's anti-inflation, and that's all fantastic, and it's good news for the economy, and it's making us look like we knew more than we did a year ago when we were saying we didn't see a recession coming.
And despite all that, stock market went down.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, which is classic. This is just,
and the reason
classic.
I'm going to say the probable reason that the stock market declined is because Treasury interest rates went up, not short-term rates, longer-term rates. And again, it was the downgrade by Fitch because of the ongoing threats to not pay our debts. That's going to make things expensive and awkward.
Are you allowed to say Fitch on the radio?
I certainly hope so. That's the name of the company.
Yeah. And they downgraded
three major bond rating companies. And So we no longer have the AAA rating at the top of the world. The fact is,
S&P lowered us back the last time we threatened to not raise the debt ceiling and default on our bonds. Now Fitch is doing it. It's basically they're saying, hey, you guys keep threatening. One of these times you're going to do it.
Yeah, that would be, and still, that is the biggest nightmare on our plate economically. We only got 1 year.
Yeah.
Because a year from now, the agreement expires. And if a year from now, when the agreement, or a year from this spring, the agreement expires, I try to be bipartisan on this, but.
And it's an election year, which means.
If the Republicans in the. If the more right-wing Republicans in the House again threaten to have the Treasury not pay our bills, it may have a significantly negative effect on the economy.
And we're picking on them. Democrats have done similar things in the past. This is not an anti-Republican push. We're looking at this as an anti-stupid push. You guys are you got to pay the bills. Yeah, I mean that not paying the bills. It's definitely a bad, I'll say a lot of bads, lots more bads, bad thing if the United States government doesn't pay its bonds. Everybody says, oh, they'll pay their bonds. But we've now had two last minute deals in the last 10 years or so that barely prevented us from defaulting on our debt. That's just not a good thing. It's really not a good thing. I may believe a great deal about, you know, fiscal responsibility, making sure that we're paying our way. I believe that our budget should be carefully managed. I believe we need to keep our debt under control. All of this stuff, that's reasonable. Saying, I want to keep our debts under control, so I'm just not going to pay them, that's really not logical in any way, shape, or form. It's bad thinking. And if you do that and you're owing child support and you say, my debts, you know I was supposed to pay that. I agreed to it. The law said I would. I just didn't. That's what you go to jail for. If we don't pay our debts to the United States government in the form of taxes, we go to prison. If they don't pay theirs, it's against the Constitution. I think we should just impeach the whole Congress. But the problem is that the people that get to impeach Congress is Congress. I don't think they're going to do it.
No.
I think that's a problem. And I know I'm making enemies by saying the Republicans aren't all the bad guys. And I know I'm making enemies by pointing out that the Republicans are making bad decisions. That's unfortunately, when you look at economics, it isn't politically based. If we're looking at the well-being of the long-term economic output of our country, we got to pay our bills. We can't overstimulate the economy, and we certainly can't understimulate the economy. If we do that, we do what the European Union did during the global financial crisis and maintained a much longer recession than we did, even though we had essentially the same issues, the same problems. So it puts us in a weird spot to be just listen back to the radio programs when the entire world was yelling that we're having a recession in the middle of 2023. And we were saying, well, we don't see it. I mean, it could happen, but all the things that everybody's pointing at don't look like recession to us. Not paying the bills is a bad idea. There. Okay. So Fitch's U.S. credit rating, it's bad. But when we look at the rest of the economy, it's bad. It's a bad we knew about months ago. Fitch is only now saying we're lowering the credit rating. We were already past the crisis when it happened. So it's weird that the market responds, oh, Fitch doesn't think it's a good idea to not pay the debts. Well, they knew that. This is what they are. They're a bond rating agency. They don't think it's a good idea if people don't pay debts. But the market reacted badly, as if it was surprised that Fitch would say, if you don't pay your debts, or you threaten to not pay your debts, you're not quite as likely to get a loan from us. It's just common sense, but hey, the market responded. Okay, what else do you have to talk about?
Well, man, there's so many things.
I've got some warehouse good stuff warehouse too rents, when you're ready. Go ahead.
Warehouse rents are rising, which is the reverse of what we see elsewhere. Quite a few people have asked me about real estate, and is real estate going to fall apart, and should we be invested in any way in real estate, meaning mutual funds that invest in real estate stocks associated with real estate companies. There's basically a division there. And the one that's making the news is the losing side. And the losing side is that major office buildings, huge buildings full of offices in big cities, are coming on the market substantially below the price they last sold at. In other words, for example, because of his name, it makes headlines. Trump Towers is down significantly. They're trying to sell it, and they can't find anybody to pay even at 70% of the price that they paid for it.
Yeah.
Why? Well, first off, it's getting really, really hard to get in and out of cities because there's only so much highway and there's a lot of cars. Some people are moving into the city still, but there's a critical shortage of housing in cities, condominiums and apartments and so on. And they're very expensive. So people are leaving the city and working remotely. There's a lot of that going on. All of it nets out to the fact that there are huge office buildings in every city in the United States that companies own and then lease to other companies to use that are partially, and in some cases, mostly empty. And when the lease comes up for renewal, the company that previously leased it just isn't leasing it anymore. If they can get somebody to lease it, they lease it at a much lower cost, much lower rent than they had before. And the issue is, of course, if you can convert that office building into apartments and condominiums, the value is there, but it's not, you're going to see a lot of investment have to go into it, which means that the price drops. So there's an area in real estate that really is in trouble right now, and it makes a lot of news. But there's a lot of other areas in real estate that are not in trouble, and this is where good management comes in. Medical clinics, medical anything just about, because we have an increasing demand as the baby boomers age for more and more medical services. So renting out, building a building that's designed for medical use, and believe me, you have to design it because it needs to have oxygen lines running through it and a lot of other things that other buildings don't have. They're doing really well. And I just said that apartments and condos inside economically healthy cities are doing exceptionally well. So you got two sides. People are asking me about if they should just bail completely out of, if we should basically bail completely out of real estate. No, you just need to be selective. And one of the things we do is look at the history of a portfolio and the management of the portfolio, for instance, in a mutual fund. And we look for the managers that have managed to stay abreast of what's going on in real estate and have not gotten themselves locked in. Problem with real estate trusts, and a lot of people use real estate and REIT, real estate investment trusts, for their real estate investment, is a real estate investment trust generally buys a particular kind of real estate and hangs on to it forever. which sounds really cool until you realize that in a changing economy, whatever you bought into that looks like it's going to go on forever almost certainly won't. And therein is a problem. So it's not a simple answer when people, I've been asked that question quite a few times, so I thought I'd bring it up. It's not a simple answer. And it's one you have to be aware of and you have to be cognizant of what you're doing. And I've got a little more, but I've been talking for a while. You need to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the logistical issues that infrastructure acts were intended to work on. So the Trump administration and the Biden administration both worked hard to pass an infrastructure bill to build infrastructure. The Trump administration wasn't able to push it through a Democrat Congress, and the Biden administration almost wasn't able to push it through either. It was called the Inflation Reduction Act. It's just a label that has absolutely nothing to do with what's actually in the law, but it's called the Inflation Reduction Act. Well, it has all these chunks of money to be invested in infrastructure. Some of that is going to green energy, and we're seeing a big boost in green energy production in the United States. Solar, wind manufacturers are doing well because there's grants and there's loans available for them to create these better technologies. Okay. There's a lot of pushback. Why is it being spent on green stuff? There's other stuff in there for roads and bridges and dams. Unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of dams and water lines that are not covered on this. Water lines, pipes, things like that. So I've got a couple of quick examples, one of which is very near to us. The Guadalupe River between 2016 and 2019 had 4 dam failures. This isn't something people hear about or talk about. They didn't cause a loss of life. There was nobody downstream that got flooded out, or not many. So it wasn't a big national event. These dams were all built in the 1920s through the 1940s. They're about 100 years old. Well, what are they? Well, some of them were hydroelectric dams, just very little ones, that hold little bits of lake. Well, when they failed, they're privately owned. They're sort of privately owned in that they're kind of owned in the commons, like a contract between a group of people on a driveway that says, when we repair this, we all have to pitch money in. But you have to vote on it to do it, and the people didn't want to do it. So these dams failed. So we have this new concept of a special taxing authority being created based on, it's basically a new government that's only around taxing to either rebuild a dam or something along those lines. The same's true for a lot of bridges, a lot of roads. When big developments were made in the 1960s, if the development was around a golf course, many of the roads in the development were owned by the golf club, by the people that owned the golf course. They owned the roads through all of the residential areas. Who pays for their upkeep? These are things that are really major issues in how we maintain, not expand, but just maintain the infrastructure that we have. And the last part of this is just south of Fort Worth, near Venus, Texas. For the second time in the last 5 years, a water leak at a prison, a major water leak, a pipe failed underground at a prison, and it drained the town of Venus's water tank because it happened over a weekend. So how did these pipes fail? Well, they're really old. They're made of iron. And if you put water in iron for an extended period of time, there's a chemical reaction that, I know it's a rare one, most people aren't familiar with rust, but we've got pipes made out of cast iron. We still have places where we have pipes made out of lead. The Wall Street Journal just had a series of articles over the last several weeks about the lead in the old telephone lines that aren't even being used anymore because we have newer telephone lines that are made of fiber optic, but we've got underground lead wires going underneath creeks all over the country that are still owned by AT&T because Ma Bell did the digging in the 1920s using lead. Well, we got to do some stuff about that. If we don't, this is one of the major issues. We're starting to see lead in a lot of the drinking water. The forever chemicals that we know about now, the ones that come from plastics in the water, well, we now know how to get them out of the water. But the absolute vast majority of drinking water sites that filter water for tap water, don't even test for it. Well, we don't know the danger there, but this is the United States. This is the place where we say, don't drink the water when you're in Mexico. Don't drink the water when you're in the Caribbean countries. Don't drink the water when you're in South America. Don't drink the water in Texas. That's not cool. Don't drink the water in California, in Michigan. Not, we can do this. We actually have the ability to do it, but it takes money. We have to allocate it from other places. And this is difficult because it's money on stuff that just exists. And this is one of the things, the Wall Street Journal article about one of the dam failures on the Guadalupe River was, hey, you know, it was originally a hydroelectric dam. It was created by an electric company. The electric company failed a long time ago. There's still some electricity being produced, but it's going directly to Encore. And now Encore has for years said, well, we can't replace the dam. We don't. It doesn't produce enough electricity to pay to make a dam. That's expensive. So now the locals are making the dam, and a large portion of the dam value, I just like saying that, by the way, a large portion of the dam value had more to do with the beauty of the lake.
Did you meant to say, I think, that Encore didn't give a damn to them.
Exactly. Encore didn't give a damn, said that their electricity production wasn't enough to give a damn.
Yes.
And so now they have to tax themselves to give a damn. And so they are. They're taxing themselves into giving a damn for their little lake. But that is what a lot of the infrastructure reinvestment is coming down to. Very local infrastructure spending. And that's the sort of thing that I would hope that the federal government would allow some money to make loans for, so that we have ones that don't fail for hopefully more than 100 years this time. And that's the thing, is that how long are we building for, and are we maintaining what we have? There's a lot of bridges that still need to be repaired that are near failing across the country. Those are all important pieces when we're looking at the growth of the GDP, when we're looking at what are we doing to maintain it. And that's a governmental side of things, but it's the sort of, there's two areas that the government can spend money on and increase their tax revenue: infrastructure spending and education, if they do it right. And unfortunately, what we have is massive bureaucracies around both of those institutions that limit how we spend the money and aim it in ways that are less productive. When we have money from the federal government to improve infrastructure, quite often it gets used on things like some congressional representative's pet project in a district, because they get votes by saying, look, I fixed a pothole that people are annoyed about, rather than using that same money to fix the dam that's upstream that's not quite broken yet. But it might have more damage than a pothole at some point in the future. So how we allocate the money isn't being well thought out. There's no engineers involved in this. It is a very political thing. And having some awareness in your own known people, you who are listening to us about this, you having awareness will affect your conversations with your representatives. And this doesn't, I don't care if they're Democrats. I don't care if they're Republicans. These are common problems. We can look at this and say, we need to give a damn. So I have beat that damn subject to death. And now on to you,
have,
sir.
You have. There is a bill that has been introduced by John Larson into the House of Representatives, which has a lot of merit. It's called the Social Security 2100 bill. I don't know if you've heard anything about it, but basically what it says is, it starts off by saying there would be a minimum Social Security benefit for somebody who qualifies for Social Security, which raises the payments to the lowest income people. It increases the taxable amount that people receive from Social Security anywhere free. I think it adjusts for inflation after the first year. But if for instance, a couple's income is over $50,000, then they pay 85%. They get taxed on 85% of their Social Security. But the big thing it does is it imposes the Social Security tax on everybody, no matter how much money you make. You know, there's a cap right now. If you make too much money above that level, you don't pay Social Security tax because your Social Security doesn't go up above that level. And the end result of that law, that bill, according to the Social Security actuaries, is that it will extend the life of the Social Security Trust Fund, if it's enacted this year, in this Congress rather, to about 2065. Now, for those of you who've forgotten about this or may not have known about it in the first place, in 2034, the actuaries of the Social Security Trust Fund have said the fund will run out of money. That is not a long time from now. That's 11 years from now. I think many of the people who are listening will be affected by that. If the law remains the same, at that point when the trust fund runs out of money, the payments will drop to 74% of what's currently being paid. So if you're receiving Social Security or you anticipate receiving Social Security in the future, look at the numbers and say that
you got a 26% drop.
About 10 years from now, you will have roughly 3/4 of that income, not the whole thing. If the new bill were to be passed, which it wasn't last year, it's come forward this year with some minor modifications been reintroduced, it extends the life of the Social Security Trust Fund to 2065. I think since it's relatively painless, admittedly, it does mean that people of higher income will suddenly have an additional tax that they have to pay on their wages if you're making over $400,000 a year. And that's going to upset the people who make more than $400,000 a year because they will then be paying Social Security and Medicare taxes again. But it will keep the Medicare Trust Fund and the Social Security Trust Fund alive to 2065, which I think is a reasonable thing to do.
And one of the things that I need to point out here, if you're listening to this program and you wish for Social Security to continue for you or for other people that are receiving it, by definition, that is socialist. That's not bad. Having a safety net for our people that are in retirement is a good thing. But it is, by definition, economically a socialist institution. It is in the name, Social Security. I want to lay that out just to get it out in the open. When people say, hey, I don't want to pay above a certain amount of, you know, if you know anything, if you're self-employed, if you know anything about paying taxes for self-employed, when you pay your quarterly taxes, when you're looking at it, your self-employment tax is the replacement for the Social Security and Medicare part of the taxes that are done by the employer and the employee. But there's a cap. If you make above a certain amount of money, you don't pay the taxes on that money anymore. And that cap was put there because they said, well, we're capping the amount of Social Security income you will receive, so you might as well cap how much taxes you'll pay. Something, again, to point out, this is not an advocacy for it or against it. Simply, if you support Social Security in any form, that's a socialist program, and this is a socialist method of paying for it. Anytime you have taxes that are based, have a higher percentage on people that make more money, that is also a socialist method of taxing. So what is being said here is we pay for this by taxing people that have more, that are making more money. That is one method of paying for it. And it's right now the only effort in Congress to save the system. And if you don't save the system, there's going to be a 26% reduction in income when the trust fund doesn't have enough money anymore. So I'm going to hand it back to you to let you take back.
The cap, by the way, on income above which Social Security taxes are not paid is $160,200 in 2023. It rose $13,200 because it rises with inflation. And everybody below that pays 6.2% Social Security tax on the first $160,000.
And that's true for the people that are capped out and don't pay it above that. They are paying the max amount, in essence. It's not like they're avoiding taxes. They're paying the most amount being paid by anyone in Social Security are the people that are capped out.
And, of course, the employer also pays money into the Social Security Trust Fund matching the money that you pay into the Social Security Trust Fund, unless you're self-employed, in which case you pay both of them. Well, that is the way it was set up originally. The problem with the way Social Security was set up originally is the life expectancy in the United States, with Social Security starting at 65 when it was set up, was 66, which means roughly half the people were expected never to draw on the Social Security. The understanding was that people, twice the number of people would pay into Social Security as would take it out.
No, man, I got a sound effect for that.
Well, it was based on the life expectancy tables of the day.
Right.
It was a completely accurate assumption.
And it's a good number when you say half of you won't get this. Isn't that great? It'll make it work. But then we decided to live longer. Okay, go ahead. Now we're living longer.
Of course, the problem is that our life expectancy, at least some of us have a life expectancy that is rising. Now, that's life expectancy actually fell during COVID because a lot of people died of COVID and will die early because of COVID, a very substantial number of people in the United States. We're talking in the millions here. But post-COVID, the life expectancy is starting to inch back up again. And
hold on, I have to play the sad sound effect. People are living longer again.
I think you're beating that sound effect.
I'm just saying, all of these people need to just stop living so long and we'll save Social Security. That's not the solution. We need to figure out a better solution to Social Security than eating old people. Eating the old is not a good way to maintain Social Security. So where do we get the money?
Several years ago, we changed the law so that the Medicare tax didn't cap out at the same level as the Social Security tax. It continues to be paid as it goes up because everybody gets Medicare. It would be a little bit of a departure from the principles that have run the system so far, which is if you pay into it, the more you pay into it, the more you get out of it on Social Security. Because upper income people would not get more, they would just pay that 6.2% tax. But it would keep Social Security alive. Something is going to have to happen in the next 10 years to keep Social Security alive. And the longer we wait to raise the taxes, the more painful the tax increase will have to be, the larger the tax increase will have to be to keep it alive. I strongly encourage you to contact your congressman and say that you support the Social Security 2100 Act. I'm sure if you make over $160,000 as an individual, you will not like the idea that if you make that on regular wages, that it will go up. There's also a provision in there to tax some investment income. I don't have the details on that. I haven't looked deeply.
I'm looking at it here. It does. That was a proposal that's not in the original plan.
It wasn't in the original plan, but I think they brought it in this year. They've dropped it this year. One, I don't know which. But the bottom line to it is, we either are going to and this is the thing I was going to say about the deficit, which we talked about last hour, and the fact that there's members of Congress who are willing to go to draconian lengths to lower our spending. There is literally, folks, no way we can cut spending enough to even come close to balancing the budget in these relatively healthy economic times. I know this has got to be one of the most unpopular things I could possibly say. Our federal income taxes are too low. I hate paying federal income taxes at least as much as anybody else does. Maybe more, but there's a reality. If we don't want to see the deficits continue to pile up at a phenomenal rate of speed until eventually we can't pay the bill, we have to do one of two things. We have to cut majorly in the United States government,
that would require us cutting either Social Security, Medicare, defense, or other major retirement stuff.
The biggest two items. Social Security Trust Fund, of course, is in there, and the Medicare Trust Fund is in there. Let's set those aside for just a moment because this bill addresses them. Let's address just regular federal expenditures that the members of Congress want to cut. The only places that we can cut enough to make any significant difference, even get us back to a significantly lower deficit, are defense and civil service retirement and military retirement. Those are not things we want to cut. Military, civil service, retirement, and the defense budget. I wish I could tell you that there was much bigger things we could do, that somewhere else we could cut waste and fraud somehow, There is certainly a massive effort ongoing continuously to cut waste and fraud. However, with each bill that's passed designed to cut waste and fraud, they increase the waste. Why do they increase the waste? I was in the Army, and I got to look at the methodology that's used to price things in the Army. And the problem is that Congress has set so many requirements that the bureaucracy and restrictions and minimum requirements for something as simple as an Allen wrench are so huge that I had an Allen wrench in the tool room of the armored cavalry troop that I commanded that was worth $1,000, a little Allen wrench that, by the way, you could go down at that point to Walmart and buy it for a few cents, but it was worth $1,000. Why? Because of all the restrictions that had been placed in it on making that Allen wrench.
Yeah. So if you think that the words prevent waste and fraud, when said together like that, is an oxymoron. It's a word that means the opposite of itself. How do you prevent fraud in the government? Well, by having lots of people check to make sure that what you're doing isn't fraud. Well, that's wasteful to have lots of people check it. It prevents the fraud, though. So it's a difficult thing. We need to have oversight over the government to make sure it's not spending money improperly. But you can't do that for free. Oversight over spending costs money. It's completely, horribly nightmarish to think about it from that perspective. But if we don't spend money on preventing fraud, we get fraud. And the Allen wrench costs $1,000 because they're putting it in their own pocket. If we don't prevent the fraud, then we have to have 97 different people inspecting it along the way, which costs the same amount of money as the person putting it in their pocket. We got to have a better way of doing this. Hopefully, we can automate it and blockchain it. But when the government does it, it's going to be expensive and inefficient any way you look at it.
My recommendation is to simply, of course, I don't think we could get all the literally hundreds of bills that affect the manufacture of that Allen wrench off the books. Militaries are by definition inefficient. They're not designed to make money. They're designed to get something done. And unfortunately, the politics come into it pretty quickly. The Air Force for many years has been trying to get rid of the A-10, but the place, I don't remember the name of the congressman, but there's some very powerful congressmen and senators who would lose the manufacturing of the A-10 or parts for the A-10 in their districts who've kept the A-10 alive for a long time. The A-10 is not an effective aircraft anymore, and the Air Force has very gradually been phasing them out. But they wanted to get rid of them 20 years ago and couldn't. So we have a problem and we need to do commercials.
Yes. If you'd like to email us and stimulate our somnolent brains, email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That is thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important messages. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
I just sent you a link from the treasury.gov fiscal data, and it calculates the spending done by the U.S. government. And the spending on the U.S. government, this isn't talking about which percentage of it is debt and which percent of it is revenue. But when you add in Social Security, health, Medicare, income security, which is kind of all related to the same stuff, you get 61% of the spending. You throw in national defense, and now you're at 74%, and then interest on the debt, and you're at 84%. Now, we're not talking about education or veterans benefits yet. So we're going to throw veterans benefits in there too, because this is an entitlement thing. If we could, now we're talking about 89% of the budget is defense and entitlement. That's what you're dealing with. We don't want to cut Social Security. We don't want to cut Medicare. And when you're talking about national defense at a time when major powers are invading their neighbors just for the fun of it or threatening it, we can't cut back on that. That means 90% of what we're doing is entitlements and defense. That means that leaves 4% for education. That's true. 2% for transportation, also true. Community and regional development, 2%, and other, 4%. So where do we cut? And this is the thing that when people come and then we say we got to cut back on fraud and waste, Social Security's got some fraud in it. And if you can find the fraud, there's actually rewards for that. You can get great benefits for finding Social Security fraud or Medicare fraud, because we've instituted big reward programs for reporting it. You can make a lot of money by finding somebody who's doing the fraud. The problem with it is there's just not a lot of it. As a percentage of the total budget, it's there, but it's not as high as a Nike shoe store and crime. Crime for a Nike shoe store represents a larger, much larger percentage of their bottom line than fraud and Social Security and Medicare. Now, it could just be that we're not finding it all. But I think with the rewards being as high as they are for finding it, that we're finding a lot of it. So there could be some more out there, and we could possibly bring that down, bring the price of Social Security and healthcare at the governmental level, including Medicare and Medicaid and all of that. We could bring that down, but only by a small amount. So cutting the budget, we have to cut things that nobody wants to cut. Nobody wants to cut Social Security. Nobody wants to cut Medicare. So that leaves cutting the budget as not a viable side of things. So what else can we? Well, we can stimulate growth. We can put stimulus into the economy. Well, that's more money. Where do we get that from? Debt? Well, that's why we have a deficit. Because these other areas that we don't wish to cut, anything else that we're doing is debt. That means we're left with only increasing revenue. That's taxes. I don't like that either. But if we're going to continue to spend like this, at some point we're going to have to do it. 5 years ago, net interest on the debt was only 2% of the budget. It's now 10% of the budget and growing because interest rates are up. So how do we come up with the money? Well, we could forgive all of those student loans. Well, no, because those student loans are actually revenue to the government. Well, we could forgive them for people that are in public service and use that as a benefit. Okay, well, that's more debt. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm not saying everybody has great student loans, so they should just pay them. I'm not saying any of that. What I'm saying is if we pay the student debt back for them at the governmental level, we get less revenue. Do we want to increase our interest rate on student debt? Well, that's a direct investment in our productivity later on down the road. Our economy grows and our tax revenue grows when we invest in education. People that have student loans tend to pay more in taxes than people that don't. And people that paid off their student loans tend to pay a lot more in taxes than people that don't. Well, why is that? Well, because they're better educated. They have better paying jobs. So they pay for themselves. That's cool. And forgiving that might lead them to go on and make even more money. That could be a stimulus, but it's more debt for us because where do we get the money to pay it back? Well, we just forgive it. Okay, well, that means that in essence, on the balance sheet, it's negative. It sounds like we're advocating to raise taxes.
Yes.
And we are. And we're going to be the ones that are in the central crosshairs when it happens personally. And I'm a libertarian, and I'm saying if we're going to keep doing this, we have to raise taxes. Well, I wish that people would take the money that they were paying into Social Security and could invest it in a portfolio kind of like a TSP. Well, that would be a better alternative. Yes, it would. But a lot of people in Britain did that and blew their money by timing the market completely wrong. And the government still had to come back and save them. So some kind of education program to teach them how to invest the money might be nice instead of just saying, here you go. No safety net. You try that balancing act.
There's two things as we come to the end of our second hour and the end of our broadcast this week that I wanted to comment on. One, the number of scams, Ponzi schemes, and so on is mushrooming. If somebody is offering you, particularly somebody you're affiliated with, like a member of your church, an unusually high return and secret insider, whatever, you're being ripped off. If you can't find the investment on Morningstar, it probably doesn't exist, and it's going into the guy's vacations and ranches and mansions and so on.
He's getting a good return on his scam.
Yes. Wells Fargo has had a series of actions by the various regulatory agencies against them for opening false accounts. And they just got hit with another series of complaints and a lawsuit on the same thing. Apparently, they're opening up accounts for people and charging them for the accounts when the people literally never asked to open an account, and it's open anyway. It appears to be happening again. Very recently, if you are a Wells Fargo banking customer, be sure and check your deposit report versus what you put in, because Wells Fargo customers are reporting, and Wells Fargo has acknowledged it's happening, says it doesn't know why it's happening, but they're trying to fix it. That people, for example, deposit $2,000 in their Wells Fargo account and it's gone. It's not there. So keep your eyes open for these things, and we're out of time.
Yeah. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter or read it there. You can contact us through the contact form. You can listen to our radio programs going back lots of years, read our newsletters going back a long ways. You can find our podcasts anywhere you find podcasts. If you would like to email us directly, we would appreciate that. We actually do read those things. Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. We appreciate you folks that tune in to us every week and on the podcast more than we can say. Thank you for listening to The Personal Wealth Coach.